You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Rule number one, don't open the door.
Wow, how did they film that? What is going on?
I think that was one of the best scenes I've seen in a lot of movies.
When you're watching them, you're like, what am I watching?
I don't even want to talk about it.
Oh, no, you love me. You know you love me.
This is like art, dude. This is like right in your face incredible.
I can't stop watching it. What the hell is going on?
What the hell is going on?
I mean, I fell in love with it from the opening credits.
It just kind of blew my mind how brilliant it was.
We just know. We can tell. We've watched so many VHS movies.
Yeah, we are sad, sad people.
Hello, hello, and welcome out there in podcast and YouTube land. We are so glad to have you with us. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, a podcast where two guys get together. We talk about horror and science fiction films, key influences that created those particular films, and then things that they in turn influenced. We say key influences, hence the title, Johnny Has the Keys. If you were finding us for the first time, wow, welcome. We'd like to extend a special welcome to you. Wish you would subscribe down there. Give us a review at the end if you enjoyed it, or even if you didn't, and let us know what you think of everything. If you're returning, we're glad you're back and glad to have you with us. We do have a website with all our past episodes. You can find those online at johnnyhasthekeys.com. My name is David. I'm here with my good friend Tim. Tim, how are you? What have you been doing
this
week?
Wow, that's a mouthful. You about ran out of breath, didn't you?
I just ran right through that. Just as quick as I could.
Oh, my, my, my. What has been going on? Well, you know, we have talked about, especially when we did Lord of the Rings earlier this year, that we were going to start branching into other genres. I mean, not necessarily other than horror or science fiction, but related genres like fantasy and thriller. And my genre week would not be considered horror. It would be considered a thriller that I would also consider covering on this podcast because I think we would have fun with it. It was a little movie called The Bad Seed.
The Bad Seed. The one with the little kid. Little girl?
Yes, right. The little girl, Rhoda is her name, came out in 1956. We recently mentioned it, I believe, briefly in our little 1950s top five. This movie, do you remember it? Have you seen it?
Vaguely, I have seen it, and I do remember
it. Or the play, because it's based on a play.
I remember seeing a good version of the play once and then seeing the movie. She kills a boy on a field trip or something, isn't it?
It's like a school trip. It's like a school function, yeah.
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 But she's just basically evil. She is just a little psycho.
Yeah, she's a psychopath.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
This was directed by Mervyn LeRoy. He was a solid contract player for MGM.
Okay.
He even directed like parts of The Wizard of Oz. He's been around. It was written by John Lee Mahin, based on a hugely popular play by Maxwell Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
It stars William Hopper. Remember him?
Yep.
20 Million Miles to Earth. We've covered that.
Mm-hmm.
It also stars Henry Jones, who is highly recognizable, Eileen Heckhart, and Patty McCormick, and Nancy Kelly. Many of these people originated the roles on Broadway or on wherever it played. I think it was Broadway.
I'm sure it was Broadway. Yeah.
Or off Broadway. Yeah, exactly. There are many reasons why I would consider this for us, mainly because it was a play, and I think we would really get into it from that aspect.
Mm-hmm.
But it's classic. It's campy. It's shocking, and it's very melodramatic. And LeRoy was really criticized for it being melodramatic. Nancy Kelly, who plays the mother, is a stage actress, so she didn't really know how to tone things down.
Yep, for
when
film.
It comes to doing film. And he took the heat for that because he was the director. Ironically enough, she was nominated for an Oscar, as was Heckhart, as was McCormick. This movie was nominated for 3 Oscars.
Wow.
Yeah. Another reason
why I did not know that. Why did I not know that? That's interesting.
Yeah, it's all the acting, though, all the females that got nominated. Nothing else got nominated. The synopsis is, Rhoda Penmark seems like your average sweet 8-year-old little girl. When her rival at school dies under mysterious circumstances at a school picnic, her mother starts to suspect that Rhoda was responsible. However, if she is right, what should she do about it? And that's the whole rhetorical question, I guess mm-hmm. you would say. I mean, the whole conundrum of the mm-hmm. play is, if you're a mother and you know your child has killed somebody, what would you do? It only scores 63% on Rotten Tomatoes, and I think that's wrong. I think that's because of what we said, it being very dramatic. I would give it 75, and I would actually give it an 85 if you view it with the fact that it was based on a play in mind.
Okay.
And just the fact that it, even though it seems melodramatic now, you could imagine it in the 50s, how shocking it really was.
Oh, yeah. I'm positive.
Because she doesn't just kill that little boy. I mean, she starts trying to kill other people, too.
Perfect.
So, yeah. That's what I did for my genre week. I've been diving into the little Turner classics, and I found that one, so...
That's interesting. And a good one. I'd like to read that play again now. Now I'm kind of, you know, because mm-hmm. I always, for some reason, I categorize that with the...
I know what you're going to say.
What?
The Children's Hour.
Yeah. I've always categorized it with Children's Hour just because it's an evil little girl.
Well, but that girl was telling lies and spreading gossip. This little girl's actually killing people.
Well, you know, in The Crucible, they're dancing in the woods naked. Come on. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
So it happens. Anyway, what did I do? I did something interesting. I went to a series I have heard about, but very little. Just heard, blah, blah, blah. And for a while, I couldn't reach it because it's an Apple TV Plus series. So, you know, Apple TV Plus, when they decided they're going to compete with Disney Plus and all the Paramount Pluses and all the Pluses out there.
Yeah, what's with the Plus?
It's just more. It's more, Tim. It gives you more.
But is anyway. There really a Disney app and then a Disney Plus app or a Paramount app and a Paramount Plus app?
Not anymore, but there is. I think it's because when they first started, they were – well, I think the first one was Disney. And it was Disney Plus because Plus meant it was their streaming service. It wasn't the Disney Channel or any of the Disney affiliates. It was streaming. It was Disney Plus. So then Paramount.
That makes sense because there was a Disney Channel forever.
And then Paramount launched the Paramount Channel, which was a streaming service. And it's, you know, its flagship was, of course, Star Trek. And then they switched to Paramount Plus. And then Apple.
And RuPaul.
Entered an Apple TV, which started to become its own kind of pseudo streaming service studio sort of thing. Creating their own content became Apple TV Plus. So I'm waiting for Hulu Plus, Shudder Plus, all the other pluses to happen. Anyway, they started out with three major series. One was, I think, called Weekend Report or The Morning Show. Morning Show, I think. It's a Jennifer Aniston vehicle.
That's actually highly ranked.
It's very highly ranked. The other one that they have now that's huge is Ted Lasso. So Ted Lasso is an Apple TV Plus that everybody loves too. So, but this one was kind of in the middle, and I had heard it was based on NASA. It was a NASA fictional sci-fi show, essentially. It's called For All Mankind.
I have never heard of it.
I had just heard briefly about it, just some little stuff and looked over it, yada, yada. But when I started thinking about it and was going, I'm searching around. What do I need to do? Let's do something different. Let's look for something. For All Mankind kind of was on my list. So I looked it up again and realized it was created by Ronald Moore. Ronald Moore is a huge sci-fi guy who's done a bunch of series and stuff, but he's mostly noted right now for Outlander, that series that's the time travel romance.
It's a big romance series, yeah.
Huge.
It was huge books when I used to work for Borders back in the late 90s, early 2000s. Those books were huge.
But before that, I had known him because he was a writer and a producer for Star Trek, Voyager, before that, Deep Space Nine, and a little bit of Next Generation. So he started Next Generation, okay. Went on to the other two series, and then he jumped ship and did a little thing called the reboot of Battlestar Galactica,
which
became huge. Mm-hmm. But he did Outlander, and then he's gotten permission to do this. And so I thought, oh, okay, well, it's got some cred, so because I like him a lot, and he's really good, so that'll work. And then I found out that one of their lead writers was Naren Shankar, who has done a bunch of stuff that I like. He was a big CSI guy for like 10 of their seasons kind of thing, and is a really cool, clever writer. He writes very unique plots. He writes some really unique kind of alternate stories kind of thing. I'm trying to remember what he was really big on. He came from CSI, but he's written for Deep Space Nine, Next Generation, Voyager, Farscape, The Expanse. He wrote a bunch of The Expanse, which you know I love. So anyway, as soon as I saw his name, I went, oh, okay, well, I got to give it a shot. Tim, it is so good. I finished the entire first season in like 2 days.
Oh, wow.
The first scene in it is all of this like archive footage, but also with original material that blends perfectly with the special effects they use blend perfectly with the archive footage. But it's essentially the first lunar landing. It's Apollo 11 landing on the moon, everything else. And you're hearing, you know, about to make a soft landing and blah, blah. You're hearing these newscasters talk about it. And, you know, and you see the astronaut come down the side limb and everything else and turns to face the camera and pulls up his, you know, sun visor thing, the reflective visor, so you can see his face. And it's not Neil Armstrong. It's a Russian. And they announce that Alexei Leonov has become the first man to land on the moon. And it's an alternate history starting in 1969.
I was going to say, it's like that one that's on Amazon, whether the Germans won World War II.
Right. The man in the tower. Man in the
High Castle.
High Castle. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's an entirely alternate universe or alternate timeline of the world based on the space race never ending. So Russians land a man on the moon, and basically that means President Nixon wants to start a military base because we got to get the commies off the moon kind of thing. And it's that kind of, what does that do to NASA? What does that do to world politics? How does that change the astronaut program? It is so unique. It is Apollo 13 done in an alternate world. And I loved every minute of the first season. It was awesome.
Okay. Has a great cast. I figured Mars would be next, but.
Yeah, has a great cast. Joel Kinnaman is the lead. I first saw him in Altered Carbon, which was another series that was really good, at least the first season. And again, this has now been renewed for its fourth season. I've only seen the first season, so I don't know about the other three, but I will end up watching.
Oh, so it's got that many.
Oh, yeah. Four seasons already in the can. So,
oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. And I have never heard of it.
And I think it's some great character work, great storytelling. It's still got all of the original Mercury 7 are in it. So you got Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong and Deke Slayton. All of them are characters in it. Even Von Braun, the rocket scientist, is in it. It's just they're having to deal with a different world sort of thing. So it's very, very interesting what they've done. And I highly, highly recommend it for all mankind. And you can get it now on anything. The first two or three seasons, you can download them or rent them or whatever. It's not, you don't have to have an Apple TV subscription or whatever. So there's
very good
that it was recommended to me and I tried it and loved it. So,
well, I'm just trying to think of a segue.
recommended. It was recommended to me. And
oh, it was recommended to you by?
It was recommended by two people who said, if you like science fiction, you need to watch For All Mankind. I went, okay, I'll look into it. And that kind of ties into our episode.
It does, because this episode is our second listener slash viewer request episode.
Woo, somebody listen.
Ta-da! This episode is brought to you by Andrew Marlar, who requested it a while back before we were doing listener request, and now that we are, we wanted to make sure and get this one in.
Andrew,
the
thanks.
The very first season we do them.
Yeah.
So thank you, Andrew, but Andrew, what were you thinking? First, let me proceed this by, we're doing a movie called The Stuff from 1985. Mm-hmm. It is written and directed by a man named Larry Cohen, who has always been on my radar, and I'm pretty sure he's always been on David's radar.
Yeah.
From the 70s and 80s. I know him primarily from a movie called It's Alive. I've never seen that movie, but I've always wanted to see it.
You've never
because
seen
of
It's
what
Alive?
I haven't.
What? Tim, I've seen It's Alive like three times. So
yeah. I think this may have been the first and only Larry Cohen movie I've seen.
You never saw Q?
No.
Oh, okay. Well,
so anyway, I wanted to see It's Alive because of the, for other reasons that we wanted to see movies in the 70s. Usually people saying, oh, Carrie, you know, they dropped blood, pig blood on her, that kind of thing. Well, in It's Alive, you always hear about the baby with the monster claws and the blood mixing with the milk and all that stuff. Yep. So anyway, that's how I know Larry Cohen. I watched this movie in the 80s and I didn't really remember it. I just remembered it wasn't that great. And I'm not really sure where to go from there without diving into another little side project movie I watched called King Cohen, which is a movie that's a biographical movie about
I watched
Larry
that as
Cohen.
Well, and I think that's a good rec for people. If so Andrew, if you like the stuff and or Larry Cohen's work, this King Cohen documentary that you can find is really good with mm-hmm. – specifically with Larry Cohen himself. It's because he's interviewed a lot in it.
Well, it gives you a better understanding of his background.
It basically messed with my world. Because there were like three or four things that it said that I had never known about and went, what? Seriously? And and so it really messed with me more than
like he created that show, The Invaders.
The Invaders. Is that what you were gonna, one of my yeah. favorite 60s shows, and he created that. And Branded. I still can sing the song from Branded, you know, and he created that. He got dumped from it really quickly, but it was one of his. So That just freaked me out.
Well, I think what we discovered is that he was a solid television writer, but he had an affinity to be a director. So he would take very little money and produce his own directorial efforts, and they're not that great. And I think he was just a successful television writer that wanted to be a director, and he was always better as a television writer.
I guess. I mean, I wanted to have the time to go back and watch like some of his classic episodes, you know, of stuff that he had written and done to see if it was good or not. Because especially this documentary praises him for how fast a writer he was, how good a writer he was, how incredible a television writer
he was.
Well,
how open he was to changing things
on
the spur of the moment.
I don't see that at all in any of his frickin' movies. And so maybe he's different as a director than as the writer. But I have always equated Larry Cohen with Roger Corman. That same kind of thing. Guerrilla photography, very low budget. Hey, Spanky's got a barn. Let's shoot a movie, you know, kind of approach to stuff. And it shows. And I think it definitely shows in his aesthetic and his stuff and everything else. The best thing he ever did was It's Alive. And it actually has.
I figured it was. That's why I wanted to do it. So
yeah,
maybe we'll still get to it. It's on the list. But we ended up doing the stuff because mm-hmm. Andrew said, hey, I like this movie. It's fun. It's from the 80s. Why don't you guys cover it?
Okay.
So a real quick synopsis is that when a mysterious white and gooey but delicious substance begins oozing from the Earth's surface. It's a floor wax. No, it's a dessert topping. It makes a good new dessert, a great new dessert product, but this new dessert has a sinister origin. It's an entity that takes over victims' minds while making them crave more of it. And that's basically the premise of this movie.
Yeah.
It's habit forming, mind controlling, life absorbing. You can never get enough of the stuff.
Yes. You cannot. Had you seen this movie before? You said you hadn't, right?
I think we rented it back in the 80s and just kind of threw it away. I don't think we really paid that much attention to it afterwards. Mm-hmm. The main thing I remember about this movie the most is that Garrett Morris is in it. I've always liked Garrett Morris. He's an original Saturday Night Live cast member. But, I mean, they use him for, like, comic relief, kind of. I mean, they don't really – it's not like he's spectacular in this movie or anything.
And I wonder
Moriarty. Well, go ahead.
One of the key things that came out of that documentary that I was not aware, another thing I was not aware of, he was huge in the blaxploitation era.
He was.
The whole blaxploitation film era was a huge Larry Cohen. He produced a lot. He wrote a lot. He directed a lot. He, you know, Black Caesar and a bunch of others.
That Black Caesar he was famous for, and yeah. He did several sequels, I'm pretty sure.
And a lot of those. So I'm sure that the Garrett Morris thing maybe came because of an association that he had developed in that time period of thing from it. But, I mean, he's almost a token sort of written character in this. A lot of this movie is terribly written. I'm sorry, Andrew. We don't mean to offend you. You just ask our opinion, so we thought we'd give it to you. There were literally sequences in this movie I was wanting to turn it off. I was going, I can't endure it anymore. And I was trying to remember. You know, it's one of those where we've said before on the podcast where we watch it and go, you know, it just wasn't as good as I remember it when I was a kid, or it wasn't as good as I remember it when, you know, I watched
this
it.
This was exactly as I remembered it. Is that what you were going to say?
Yeah, pretty much. It was exactly as bad as I remembered it. I was going,
But then again, I mean, and no fault to Andrew, because we do cover bad movies on this podcast as well.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you equate Larry Cohen with Andrew, Roger Corman.
Yeah.
I equate him with Frank Henenlotter.
Oh, I could see that.
But
too.
The only thing is Frank Henenlotter, to me's movies are more enjoyable and fun, even though, like, this movie was made for $1,700,000.
Mm-hmm.
Basket Case was made for $35,000. Which movie do you like more?
Oh, yeah. Basket Case, definitely, of the two.
Exactly. So, I mean, at least – and both of them are guerrilla photographers. They both go out and film when they're not supposed to be. They don't get permits. And Larry was a master at it. And like you said, Roger Corman probably did it occasionally as well. But I think Henenlotter and Larry were probably the kings of it, especially in New York.
But I guarantee the bulk, because the bulk of this, I even wrote on my thing, where was this shot? Was it shot in the South? Was it shot in North Carolina? Blah, blah, blah. No, it's shot in California. But
okay.
I guarantee the bulk of that budget went to marketing, went to internal marketing for the movie, which means you have to have all those containers. You have to have all that printing done. You have to have all that stuff, literally the stuff.
The stuff.
Sort of thing. The factory. And everything else. So I'm sure that there were, you know, that's where the bulk of it went, because it sure as hell didn't go to the script or the direction or lensing or lighting or anything else.
So. No. And I started to mention Michael, but I'll get to him when we get to casting, because Michael Moriarty is a familiar with Larry Cohen. He's in several Larry Cohen movies.
I mean, I think this... My overall take on this movie was it falls into that could have been, which I would rather watch a bad movie. I mean, like a really, really bad movie than a could have been movie. Because the bad movie is at least you know, oh, it is just what it is. This guy was just, you know. But this one actually does have
Or it's intentional. Yeah.
Yeah. This one actually does have two or three, you know, potential sort of things about it. I mean, Michael Moriarty is a quirky actor and could have been played a lot better had the script been stronger, I think. The same thing with Paul Sorvino. And the
love Paul Sorvino.
The premise of this slowly taking over sort of thing, which I'm sure we'll mention a lot of keys when we get there, again, could have been even better. And if you wanted to make a social sort of commentary, then make it even more so than what they did. But they didn't. It was just all this kind of slapped together sort of feel to it. And so much things just that just did not make any sense to me. It just kept pissing me off. I mean, I've got in my notes, we've got in my watch notes, I say, where is it? I was wanting to find it because of the, we've got, where did I put it? More than one jingle. Oh, that's over there. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of catchphrases and stuff as far as like making fun of advertising.
Yeah, but I mean, we've got like the discovery.
That's what I was going to say. That's weird to me.
We've got the discovery. We've got the discovery that it's delicious. We've got it marketed and in somebody's house, and we've got it's all alive within the first like two literal minutes of the movie. I mean, everything is just right there in the front. I was like,
well, and what it is some dude's walking and he sees it bubbling up out of the earth and he immediately eats it. It's like, who does that?
No.
Nobody.
No one would do
that. You don't just pick something up off the ground and eat it.
It was.
I mean, did he smell it? Did it, you know, mind control him? Nothing. He just kind of picks it up and eats it. I was like, no.
Yeah, if it had
splashed
or gotten on his mouth or something like that, I could have understood. If it had suddenly reached up and gone right into his mouth, and yeah, maybe. But no, you don't
or
say,
jumped
hey,
into his mouth. Yeah,
found this on the ground here. Lick it. Here, lick it. Go ahead. No.
Right. I mean, we saw that guy in The Blob get it on his stick and it get on his hand, but he didn't try to eat it.
See, that was scary, but he didn't try to eat it.
Let's see. We forgot to mention Larry also did, besides It's Alive, he did Return to Salem's Lot, which is a notoriously horrible sequel, as well as a movie called God Told Me To that I remember because Tim Funk always had that poster. Tim Funk, who recommended our last listener request episode, had the poster of God Told Me To on his wall. And I always was like, what is that? You know? Anyway. And as you said, he was a prolific television writer, created The Invaders, wrote episodes of Columbo, NYPD Blue, and lots of other critically acclaimed television shows. So it's weird that there's this anachronism of him being a great television writer and a horrible director.
And there were entire things in Keith Cohen where they talk about he had no script when he showed up. We just made it up as we went scene by scene. Or
not how you make a movie.
Well, you can, but you better be really good in post to be able to fix it or put it together or make sense.
Yeah. I mean, that's us with a video camera in the 80s running around.
I said, Spanky's got a barn. Let's do a show. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Did you have any scenes that stick out to you before we move on to cast?
Do I have any scenes? Let's try to be nice. I do think that the introduction of Mo or the Michael Moriarty character is a pretty good scene. When we just heard two lines of dialogue of him about how he's a corporate espionage guy, basically. He's a spy.
With the worst Southern accent I've ever heard in my life. But it's like Foghorn Leghorn bad.
He plays it so confident from the minute he walks in going, oh, sweaty bomb. Yeah. What's this over here? Another sweaty bomb. Oh, yeah. Da, da, da. And he's just so cocky about, and he literally has like, He breezes in. He stands there. He picks up his check. He walks out and says, I'll get her done. You know, kind of a.
He socks that guy in the face before he walks out.
Right. I thought.
And it goes.
Okay. As a, you know, as an intro of a character, I didn't mind that scene at all. Her introduction's terrible. Every scene she's in is basically bad. The kid.
Her being the love interest.
Yeah, the report. The
she's
marketing.
The spokesperson, like, for advertising the product, right?
Yeah, she's the marketing agent that came up with the name. Because I guess Marshmallow Fluff had been taken. So they decided the stuff would work. But.
If I had to pick out a scene.
Yeah.
I liked some of the attempts at special effects work, like when the marshmallow's crawling up the wall and they're like trying to set it on fire. I remember that's the stuff that sticks out to me, where they were actually being a little creative and trying to make it look realistic.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I mean, when you get to a scene where like Garrett Morris is going to vomit up the stuff, it's so clearly a fake head on his body in that picture behind me. I'm like, that is not good.
And held too long. The shot is held too long. So
yeah,
that's why
you can see it too long.
That it's fake. It just doesn't work. Yeah, no, there are no other scenes that.
I think it's kind of funny that the one kid, Brian Bloom, I believe is his name, he went on to be on Oz.
Jason, like or whatever. Yeah.
Jason Bloom? No, he played Jason. Scott Bloom is his like twin brother, or they just look a lot alike. Okay. Brian Bloom actually went on to be on Oz. That's what I remember him from. I was like, I know those little kids. I like that one of them is like, I'm not eating that stuff. Y'all are crazy. And the family are like mean to him. They're like trying to make him eat it. I'm like, leave that kid alone. That scene sticks out to me a lot too.
But again, I think it was his... You know, we talk about the flavor of a scene or the flavor of direction or whatever, ironically, with the stuff. I think Larry's flavor of this doesn't work in most of the scenes. Are we supposed to be scared or are we supposed to laugh? Are we supposed to see this as a comedy or horror? And, you know, Freddy Krueger can terrify and still make us laugh at times. That scene with the family could have been really scary and creepy and horrible. And you just go, oh, my God, I feel for this kid. But instead, the parents are so terrible and the brother is so terrible that it just doesn't work. Writing and acting.
Yeah, I don't think I put it in my notes, but I sent you Roger Ebert's snippet about this movie.
Oh, my God, no.
Where he basically said, you know, the reason this movie doesn't work is because it's not a horror movie, and you're selling it as a horror movie, right. And it's not, basically. Mm-hmm. And then he went back, and I'm not sure if this was intentional or not. He started billing it as a comedy, but I remember this movie coming out as a horror movie.
Oh, yeah. It was in the horror section at Blockbuster.
And I think they just tried to rebrand it as a comedy, and neither really worked to me.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, Larry would have tried to do that. I mean, he would try to do anything to market or to get his movies made or out there or seen or whatever. It's like in that documentary, they talk about Black Caesar, and they obviously had a script for it. People liked it. Mm-hmm. It worked. Da, 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 da. They premiered it, and nobody liked the ending because in the ending, the character died. So Larry said, okay, I'll just cut the ending. And we'll let him live at the end. And it was like, what? Yeah. And he goes, yeah, I can do that. I'll just do that. And it was like, all right. So obviously what did you tell me that one time when I was writing, you got to be able to kill your darlings or whatever?
Yeah, it's a Stephen King phrase. Yeah.
Evidently, he has no problem killing darlings and love interests or whatever. Just kill everything.
Darlings are like your favorite parts that you think are just great. And then you're like, oh, that really needs to go. Yeah. Before we get into cast, speaking of that documentary, how surprised were you with the caliber of people in there endorsing him?
I could not believe that.
I could not believe Martin Scorsese is saying, well, Larry Cohen was like this, blah, blah, blah. Now, I will admit, I watched his scenes a couple of times just to make sure. He never really said Larry's great. He said, Larry Cohen films are this way. So I went, okay, so you're not really endorsing him. You're just stating the obvious, you know.
Well, it's very similar to the way people talk about Roger Corman, too.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one thing to say, Larry Cohen was very involved in the blaxploitation development. Okay, fine. That doesn't mean they're good or they're good movies or anything.
And Roger Corman, there's a difference. Roger Corman produced great directors. You know, he hired them cheap, made cheap movies with them, and they went on to become super huge. You know, Ron Howard, Francis Ford Coppola, Peter Bogdanovich. I mean, all of those people were great directors. They just got their start doing cheap movies. Yeah. Larry Cohen never really went anywhere except in television writing. And he never created some superstar.
Yeah, came from television writing. But when he started, you know, even – and again, we're referring back to that documentary because I didn't know a lot about Cohen going into this.
But, me either.
You know, basically his first movie ever that he directed, he and his wife funded, you know. So, okay, you thought you could do it, and you should have gone back to writing television because evidently you were really good at that.
I don't think he ever quit. I think that's how he made money.
Well, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. I was mentioning other people besides Scorsese. I mean, J.J. Abrams is in that movie, Rick Baker, Mick Garris, who's a horror director, John Landis is in that movie.
Isn't Shao?
Eric Roberts.
Shao is in there too, talking about it. That's the guy that you, the horror
David
guy,
Scow.
Right?
Yeah.
Scow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Or, yeah, it's either Scow or Shao. I have a picture of him with Bill. I think I sent you.
I mean, Rick Baker, I could see because he developed the creature for It's Alive. And that makes sense because it is a great design. The baby is horrific.
The baby looks cool.
Yeah, it looks great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Much better than Garrett Morris behind me.
Yeah, oh, much better. Yeah.
Okay. Shall we move on to cast?
Sure.
All right. Michael Moriarty. I didn't count how many, but he's in several Larry Cohen movies.
Yes. Yeah, he became
I'm pretty
stable.
Sure he's in Q.
He is in Q.
He's not in It's Alive, but he's in I know he's in some others. Anyway, he's a character actor that Larry often casts. We know him, or people out there listening to this podcast would know him more from some of those CSI type shows you watch. What he was on one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know which one I'm talking about?
I can't remember which one, but I can't right now.
I can't either. No. Now he was a student of Stella Adler.
Yeah.
So I mean, he had some chops. But I think Larry just let him go in and improvise that character and that accent because that is the worst accent. He is just ridiculous and you don't – and for a lead character to come into a scene and you not respect him immediately, well, there goes the movie.
Yeah, but I think he was supposed to be that Snake Plissken sort of anti-hero kind of thing and he just wasn't. Mostly for the writing. And Adler, if I remember correctly, Adler was very into,
method,
very much into non-method. Play the moment kind of thing, you know, feel the energy in the room and use that and make that work kind of thing. So there might, you know, a very Brando-esque kind of acting approach. So if it feels right to do the scene
under Stella as well.
Yeah, if it feels right to do the scene this way, then do it. But a few minutes later, it feels right to do it this way. So let's do it that way. Now, as an editor, you hate that because there's no way to freaking cut that together. And that may have been some of the issues that Michael Moriarty kind of gave to us, sort of thing.
Well, the way I look at it is Moriarty. Excuse me. Moriarty has a lot in common with Larry in that they both have better success in television than they do in actual movies.
Yep. Much better.
His co-star, as you mentioned, the PR person for the stuff, was played by Andrea Markovici, who we know best from Space Hunter, Adventures in the Forbidden Zone.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I figured you'd remember that one. I don't even think that's on our list. It may not be.
Yeah. Jared Sin is the sequel to that?
Oh, no, that's Metal Storm.
That's Metal Storm.
This is Space Hunter.
Space Hunter, yeah.
Both of them, terrible 80s movies. One is a ripoff of Space. One's a ripoff of Mad Max.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's all I have for Andrea, who plays Nicole. The most I have probably are going to be about the next two. First of all, Garrett Morris is in this movie. He's from the original Saturday Night Live, as I mentioned. I watched him, you know, those first 5 years. Mm-hmm. He trained in voice at Juilliard. Did you know that?
I knew that he was Juilliard, yes.
Well, he used to sing on Saturday Night Live occasionally, and I was like, why the fuck is he singing? Well, that's why, because Lorne Michaels knew he was an opera singer or a vocalist. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Garrett's still around, still working actor in lots of television. Do you know who Larry wanted to cast in? Did I say Larry? I mean, Garrett is still around, still working. Larry wanted to cast someone else. Do you know who that is?
No.
Arsenio Hall.
Really?
I don't even remember him in 1985.
No.
I guess he was in Trading Places by then, maybe.
Probably.
Okay, that's interesting. So he was around. Larry wanted to cast Arsenio as chocolate chip Charlie Hobbs, since he thought he was not only a good actor, but a new rising star, which is legit.
Legit.
The executives at New World Pictures, however, wanted someone more recognizable, which is why they took Garrett Morris.
Give us a name. We need a name.
Yeah. When an interviewer asked Garrett Morris what director Larry Cohen was like, Morris said, I was taught growing up that if you don't have anything nice to say about someone, ouch, don't say anything at all.
Yep, there you go.
And he said nothing else. So I have a feeling some of that has to do with the guerrilla filmmaking and putting actors under pressure for very little reason.
Yeah.
But to get a shot. Garrett did not like him.
Makes sense.
You mentioned Paul Sorvino plays Colonel Spears in this movie. He also does a great little appearance in our trailer for this season.
Yeah, he does.
We know Paul Sorvino from Goodfellas and The Rocketeer. He was in Nixon. He is also the father of Oscar-winning Mia Sorvino, who won for, I believe it was Mighty Aphrodite. Wasn't that a Woody Allen movie? Something like that.
Yes.
Anyway, I've always liked Paul Sorvino. He's a great, great character actor. Michael Moriarty and Paul Sorvino went on to appear in, here it is, 31 episodes of Law and Order. That's the show Michael Moriarty is known for. Together from 1991 to 1992, as executive ADA Ben Stone and Sergeant Phil Serretta. Those were their characters on those shows. Did you ever watch that show? I didn't watch it.
No, I didn't. I wasn't a big Law & Order fan. I've seen some over the years, but not like I do CSI. I love CSI. So.
Yeah, I just remember the commercials. I remember seeing Moriarty in the commercials thinking, that's that guy from those Larry Cohen movies.
Makes sense.
Scott Bloom plays Jason. He has done very little since. Another great actor that is in this movie is Danny Aiello.
Yeah.
Very prolific actor. Mm-hmm. Was in Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing and several Woody Allen films. A lot of you Madonna fans out there may remember him from the Papa Don't Preach video. He was the dad. So he and I think Danny Aiello He either went on to be a director, or he was like Richard Masure and like the head of some acting organization or something. I can't remember, but he has done more for actors than just being an actor.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So I just knew that. And I think both him and Paul Sorvino are dead now. I don't think they're with us anymore. Patrick O'Neill played Fletcher
Yeah, he's the guy. He's also at the very end of it in the last.
He's like one of the government people?
No, he's one of the heads of the other corporation. He's the one that buys out.
That's what
out.
It is, a corporate person. Yeah. Yes. He's in a suit. I just remember that. Last we saw him was in the Stepford Wives.
Yes. He's the bad guy in Stepford Wives.
Yeah, he sure did, actually. And lots of television. He was also in The Way We Were. Oh, well.
Mm-hmm.
Postman was played by James Dixon. He has not done very much. Alexander Scourby played Evans. He was in The Big Heat, Giant, and The Shaggy Dog. He was a renowned voice actor. And then lastly, there's another famous person in this movie that's uncredited. However, he is in the King Cohen documentary. Would you like to venture a guess as to who it is?
No. Who?
Eric Bogosian.
Oh, my gosh.
He's one of the grocery store clerks.
Oh, that makes sense. I thought I recognized him. Okay. Yeah.
Anyone out there, if you've heard me mention Eric Bogosian recently, it's because he's on the new Interview with the Vampire show. He plays Daniel, the interviewer. Great actor.
Great
actor. I remember him from a show called Talk Radio that was really popular in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he did an uncredited part in this. That is what I have for cast. I will move on to awards. There are none.
Done.
And then you can. It is not on the 1001 movies you must see before you die.
Nope.
Yeah, I don't have anything else as far as that.
I took a bunch of watch notes, but they were all stuff that makes it
sure.
Doesn't matter now because it's all just why is this
well,
the way
it is? Well, we usually
do
a little bit of trivia before we go into keys. Did you want to share some of those watch notes with you?
I just thought it was very interesting. They kept not even deciding on what this stuff is literally or what it can do. So half the time they're saying don't touch it. And yet in scenes, you're seeing them covered in it, and then nothing happens if they touch it. But other times, it like immediately takes over and people start acting like, you know, stuff zombies, stuffies, they call them in it, which I don't understand either. We never got to a sole purpose of what this stuff was doing. So there's all these core elements of just basic screenplay writing that just don't work for it.
I'm hearing the song "Anything Goes" in my head now.
Yeah. The hotel room scene, although it had some interesting special effects, that was just terrible.
That's the special effects thing. Yeah.
And
like you said, people will eat it. And yet sometimes it will attack people.
Right. And so sometimes they act like they're brain controlled, but then suddenly they start exploding or stuff starts coming out of their mouths or their heads explode or whatever. And it makes – why would you – I don't understand. There's no purpose underneath. You know, as downplayed and everything as it was in Stepford, whereas we don't really know the real reason behind this other than these guys want, you know – perfect wives. There's no real, but we still got it and still grasp it and it still works. You know, the blob was trying to get bigger and take over everything. So we got that in the blob. This, I don't know.
There's no motive.
There's no motive. I don't know. And when that plays all the way through it, so you're going, all right, well then if the guy is possessed by the stuff, why does he go in the back storeroom? And if he's possessed, then why does it crawl out of him and crawl out a window? And then even down to the ending, why do we have this double ending? I knew we would have we could possibly have a sequel ending. So you have the drug lords with, you know, contraband stuff. About the sell
it's
it
called
the
something else too now.
You know,
the something else, the candy or something. I can't remember what it was.
The goo or whatever. But,
the goo.
But before that, you have the scene where Moriarty and Jason are Mo and Jason are making the two corporate execs eat it. And you're going, why? What's the why would you keep
it around, it's obviously semi-sentient and could do something to you. So why are you carrying a box of it around? B, why are you feeding it to this guy? It makes no sense because we never see anything that happens. All we do is we hear the sirens.
Because his name's Mo. His name's Mo because his name, he makes people eat stuff.
He makes people eat Mo.
He makes people eat Mo.
Yeah. The Sorvino character, I mean, he's got this small militia sort of thing, but he's not written as a very nice person at all. He's written, I mean, sexist, racist. I mean, he would fit right in today.
I would give a key to like his character being similar to James Arness in Them, in that he's like over the entire army and can use whatever weapons he wants. And
yeah, and actually that's another key that I could throw out that I wanted to ask you about because I can't remember it, but it was he reminded me of the general in the zombie movie in London when they go out. What's the name of it?
28 weeks later.
28 days later?
28 weeks later. The one where Idris Elba played the army person.
Where they go to the castle and they've got one chained up and there's an army guy
there. Oh, no. That's 28 days later. That's the first one.
That's what he reminded me
That's
of.
That's the good kind one. Of
weird, twisted, taunted general who thinks he can control everything and he's the last hope of mankind and all that. That's what I got.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. I never saw that coming, but yeah, okay.
Sorry. I get the weird ones. You know.
Well, speaking of which, since we're segueing into keys, ironically enough, I mean, Andrew knows that we've covered movies like this before that are just kind of crazy and out there, but I have several good keys for this movie. So it may not be a great movie, but it's clear that Larry lifted things he was inspired from from other movies to make this movie.
Let's go there.
Well, we've already mentioned The Blob, which would be the obvious one because it is sort of like The Blob.
Oh, yeah.
My big key, when you were saying there's no motive, the only motive I can think of in this movie is money, is they're wanting to make money off of this. And that to me is reminds me of Dawn of the Dead and the whole thing, the message about consumerism.
Yes.
So there's an underlying theme of consumerism in this that is present in a very good horror movie, Dawn of the Dead. So.
Yeah, I think, one of those, it's a could have been. It could have been played a lot worse. That commercialization and that obsession with having it and having it all and everything could have been played so much better, I think, especially in the last part of the movie. I have a good inspiration, which was at the very, very beginning. That whole opening, because, by the way, this movie just starts just like that.
Yeah. And you're in medias res.
But the way it starts and the way that was lit and looked and cool, it's probably one of the best lit scenes in the entire movie. It's where it was like a salt mine or something, wherever they filmed it. It was really cool. Mm-hmm. It looked like X-Files to me. It was very X-Files feel, you know, and the way the X-Files used to start with that hook of somebody discovering something at night alone or whatever. It was really
cool. And if they had confined it to a small town and not the entire United States, it would have been an X-Files episode.
Wow. You say that, and it reminds me, it would have been one of those Koontz books from the 80s.
Yeah, that too.
It would have been a very Koontz books if it had been a small town being taken over by the stuff. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I have, of course, Verhoeven, because of all Verhoeven movies have that kind of sarcastic cynicism of marketing. And commercials and television commercials. This one has like three different commercials, two jingles, all kinds of marketing to it. So
that's where his money went, to the jingle writers.
I guarantee it did. Yeah.
A few years back, actually it's been more than 10 probably, several documentaries came out about the fast food industry and what we eat. And those, to me, you know, there's a message in this as well as to what, you know, how healthy we are and what we eat. I was thinking in particular of Super Size Me and Food Inc.
That makes sense. Yeah.
And that is another, like, underlying message in this, you know, is what are we eating? You know, mm-hmm. we don't really know sometimes. And that's very prevalent in this movie.
If it's marketed enough, we will.
Right.
Yeah.
And again, like you said, it's a could have been. He had lots of good ideas. They just were not executed and he had no money or, well,
yeah.
or screenplay.
with jingle lines like one lick is never enough for the stuff. How could you go wrong? You know.
Oh, my God. Do not go there. All right. The scene where the kids are – the kid is trying to not eat the stuff and his family is trying to make mm-hmm. him is right out of Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yep. Got that one, too. Well, yeah. and the whole thing of –
I'm like classic sci-fi.
The whole thing of them, the two different scenes where they're being chased by – possessed stuffies is very, mm-hmm. you know, Invasion of the Body Snatchers too. And a little bit of The Thing. I have The Thing in there too. John Carpenter's The Thing.
Oh, I could see that. Yeah. Especially the 1982 version. Yeah.
Well, and he almost tapped at that a little bit with the chocolate chip Charlie thing with Garrett Morris because it turns out that he is possessed or is the thing, the stuff. In the room. Mm-hmm. I've got in the, of course, the hotel room scene. That's very Nightmare on Elm Street to me. It's what it reminded me of. The flipped room and everything pouring off the bed onto the wall and then up the ceiling.
Oh, special effect key. Yeah. You're right. It is a room filmed sideways or whatever.
Yeah. It was very Nightmare on Elm mm-hmm. Street, Poltergeist, that whole, when they were doing that in the 80s.
Gene Kelly.
Yeah. Well, Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire actually created it, right?
And Lionel Richie went on to do it as well in Dancing on the Ceiling. Yeah.
Inception sure. has it. So, yeah. The whole effect of being able to, you know, alter the perspective.
I have some keys I also lifted from IMDb.
Sure.
We talked briefly before this podcast started recording about Stranger Things.
Mm-hmm.
This movie is one of the movies playing at the Starcourt Mall. During the third season of Stranger Things.
Perfect.
You can see it on the marquee.
Perfect.
The stuff. Perfect 1980s, mm-hmm. you know, for that series. That was funny.
I had mentioned earlier Stepford Wives. Again, I think this could have been done right with a Stepford Wives approach. Like you said, if it could have been a small town, but even if it's more global and more national like it is, if we had focused on one or two people and their reactions to it and having to see it and no one believes them. In other words, the way Jason started, but he basically, you know, then how do you pair him up with Moriarty? And once you do, who cares what Jason thinks or does? Because we're following Michael and his craziness now. So I think it could have been played a little bit different and done more of that Stepford Wives feel where we don't know how it's going to end kind of thing or where it's going.
I have, and you I'm sure got this as well, that Mo tells Chocolate Chip Charlie to contact Agent Frank Herbert.
Yeah. Must have read a lot of Dune. So, yeah.
So if Larry is a successful television writer that reads sci-fi on the side, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. So. I've got the two obvious, Marshmallow Fluff and Cool Whip. So those are the
– Well, that's the product itself. I mean, Cool Whip is a strange product because there's like no dairy
in
that.
There's no dairy in it. It's all oil.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll put Cool Whip in there.
But that's
kind
of the thing. I'm wondering if one or the two of those was the inspiration for it, you know.
Maybe.
I want to do a movie like The Blob. Oh, while I'm having my marshmallow fluff, what if it's fluff and it's edible blob? You know.
I don't eat marshmallows. I hate marshmallows.
I don't either. I don't eat Cool Whip either. So so there's that.
And then my last one from IMDb is that Claire Peller reprises her parody of Where's the Beef?
Yes.
In this.
You
she
do.
Says, Where's the Stuff? If anyone was alive besides David and I back in the 1980s, there was a very popular commercial for Wendy's where she would say, "Where's the beef?" And she was a little old lady.
Yep.
And she is in this movie as well.
And again, it was ultra parodied, ultra used by everybody. Abe Vigoda is the guy who's in that with her from Barney Miller.
Oh, I seem to remember that.
Yeah, he's the guy asking her the question, and she goes, "Where's the stuff?"
I'm surprised I don't have that in my casting notes. That's hilarious.
Yeah. And the other thing, I just saw it in my notes. What the hell happened to Danny Aiello? Was he possessed or not possessed? And what was the dog? Was the dog possessed? You know, I don't understand any of that. And
I don't remember.
Made no sense.
There's lots of loose ends.
Lots of loose ends. And lots of stuff that just, okay, we're just shooting this because this is going to be the scene right now. Well, I guess we want to say thank you, Andrew, for making us watch this. No. Thank
you. Andrew, we are seriously, you know us, and we are kidding. But yeah. Pick another one.
Pick another one, and we'll do it too. Anybody out there, pick a suggestion, and we'd love to.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, that's a good way to segue, because we do want to get some more selections for next season from some of the viewers out there, or listeners.
So if you guys have something, good, bad, indifferent, that you want us to cover, we would love to do it and love to hear from you. If you are new to us and survived the stuff with us just like that, thank you. Please
stop.
List a comment down there. Rank us. If you want to go to iTunes and give us a rank, it always helps us be found by other people. It's really good for the podcast, so we'd appreciate that. Subscribe so you can find out what we've got coming up. We've got some great movies this season and some great stuff coming up. Go to the website where you can find all of our past seasons and every episode we've ever done. In addition, you could, if you really want to support us and help us, you could become a patron through Patreon. And for as little as a cup of coffee a month kind of thing, small donation, subscription, you can actually find out about some other podcasts that we have. We actually have two other ones we do, the Dilithium Chamber, which is Star Trek, the original series, and X-Files Unclassified, which is X-Files. So we're exploring some cool horror and some cool science fiction in that.
And I was going to say, we're almost through the second season of Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
So we have like 60 episodes there, plus about 20 episodes of two seasons of the X-Files. So, I mean, we're getting up there. Well, folks, it looks like the stuff got David. While I was telling you that we have great X-Files and Star Trek stuff on Patreon, we're up toward, I think, 70 or 80 episodes now. The stuff got him. He just vanished and disappeared. So I am here to close out and let you know that next week we, of course, will be having another venture into sci-fi land, and we would like you to join us. And until then, don't forget to look for all them keys out there, and we'll be seeing you soon. Bye.